Hello, this time SITREP comes to you from DSEI 2025 in London's Docklands. Hundreds of defence and security equipment manufacturers gathered under one huge roof for one of the world's biggest show and tells of military technologies and capabilities. Also, important speeches from the very top of defence. The new chief of the defence staff has told industry they need to step up investing in capacity and new products. The new defence procurement minister says he wants manufacturers to help him rip up stupid rules which slow things down. Mike and I are joined by a former two-star army officer who's played a key role in making this event happen, and the chief technology officer of one of the UK's biggest defence contractors. We'll explain and assess the job that's been set out for business to help ensure our armed forces are ready for whatever lies ahead.
Our armed forces are only as strong as the supply lines and defence industry that stands behind them.
Wars are really, really expensive. Hard capability matters even more than strategy.
Defence Explained.
We need to be ready for war fighting in a way that we have not done for many years.
History tells us that if we don't win quickly, we must also be ready to sustain that fight and adapt faster than our adversary.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Mike, I know you've just been for a look around, and it's huge, isn't it? More than 1,500 exhibitors here, getting on for 50,000 people attending across the week from more than 90 countries. You can, of course, see tanks, ships, planes, even four-legged robots and a mobile surgical unit. I'm guessing you've been here many times before.
Yes, I used to come almost every year some years ago. And superficially, it looks the same, but it isn't really. It's so much bigger. Mm-hmm. And downstairs, you can see there's some very big stuff down there, as well as outside as well, in the dock, right down to the very small, the near invisible. And looking around, some really interesting exhibits. I was talking to UK Space Command people just a little while ago. And I noticed that, for instance, Amazon and other suppliers are available, we should say. But Amazon are here, very common name, offering low Earth orbit connectivity. Okay. And that's a really cutting edge requirement for modern defence. And there is a common name, Amazon, but they're here as well. So the big names, like Thales, of course they're here. Of course the Americans are here in high numbers. But some names that you wouldn't normally expect to see at a defence exhibition, they're here as well, which shows the way defence goes right across the economy, A to Z.
It really is an eye-opener to be here, isn't it? Well, you mentioned Thales. Let's bring in our guests now. Mike Sewart is Chief Technology Officer for Thales, which makes a whole range of kits for Britain's armed forces, including drones, communication and complex weapons systems. And Major General Neil Sexton, whose army career ranged from piloting Lynx and Apache helicopters to Director of Engagement and Communication, and he's now spokesman for DSEI. Welcome, everybody. Great to see you here. And Neil, I guess as someone who has flown operations missions in helicopters, you have a particularly personal understanding of why civilian manufactured equipment is critical to men and women in uniform.
Absolutely. The 1,700 exhibitors here are providing capability that people that I know, young people mainly, are using today on the battlefield or an exercise preparing and training for operations which will be happening worldwide. And of course, we know with the imperative of what's going on after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we know just how important it is to make that acquisition of highly capable equipment more rapid. And we got that loud and clear from Mr. Pollard yesterday, the new Minister for Defence Readiness and Industry, which I think his new title gives us an idea as to how important we're seeing that ability to get equipment out to people to use.
Micah, welcome to SITREP. And you've been with Thales for what, how many days is it now?
Eight whole days.
Before that was Kinetic, another of the big beasts of the defence industry. Why does DSEI matter, not just to you as a business, but to the men and women who we may ask to fight on the front line?
Well, I think it's just a great environment to actually look at partner technologies, partner organisations. And, you know, yes, there are large organisations like a Thales, a BAE Systems, a Kinetic, but really, in the modern era, it's about how we actually bring all of that technology together and how we actually form new partnerships over time and actually bring the best of what Thales has got with for example, SMEs, with academia and with other organisations. And as Mike was saying, you know, we've got new entrants into this ecosystem as well, like Amazon and others, and those technology companies are actually creating quite a different dimension. When I joined the defence sector 8 years ago, I first came to DSEI and I was blown away by the sort of heavy engineering. Yeah. But now we see much more technology at the event. And I'm really pleased to see that as a technologist myself. And
but having said that, there's some very big vehicles down there.
Yes. There certainly are.
Something for everyone.
And I think the thing to notice about some of those big vehicles is how many of them are now removing people from the vehicles. So that introduction of robotics and autonomy across the piece. Someone asked me a question this morning, how many drones, whether they're air ones, ground ones, waterborne ones or whatever, how many are there? We can't, as the organisers, put a figure on that.
Is that right?
Hundreds, yeah.
Okay. That
is really becoming important.
And you would never have seen that two DSIs ago.
That's a new thing.
Interesting angle on that is that I've also partaked with the Consumer Electronics Show. And if you look at what happened sort of 8 years ago in CES, robotic dogs, et cetera, they were all sponsored by like DHL for delivering the mail. So now what we're seeing is that pull through of technology from non-defense sectors and actually looking at how we can actually make that technology relevant for the defense sector. So I think it's really important that we allow technology to traverse industry sectors, because that's how we get the best of everything. Really. Mm.
Neil, I mean, we've got a good sense of why it matters, but from your perspective, DSEI, I mean, someone who's served and seen it from both sides, why do you think it matters?
Because we need to move with the times. I mean, it is true in the United Kingdom Armed Forces that we're using legacy vehicles still that need to be replaced. And the speed at which they can be replaced is really important. One of the things that came out yesterday from a couple of the fora where people were talking about procurement was that it's no longer about defence, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Space Command, setting the key user requirements and then expecting industry to come up with something that meets those. It has to be more collaborative. Those requirements, actually, you know, this is the problem set we've got on the modern battlefield, and it's moving fast and changing because the opposition adapts all the time. How can you, industry, work with us to address those problems and to move with those changes so that we can win? And that's a really big change for those in the military working so much closer with industry.
Mike, some people look at this and see it as a kind of giant symbol of military-industrial complex that is ultimately about making money. Do events like this really help UK defence focus down on what they should and shouldn't buy for our defence?
Yeah, I mean, I know years ago people used to say, do you really think that a defence minister from another country will come to this and say, look around, oh, that's good, I'll have five of them, I'll have 200 of them, I'll have one of those for my own personal use, and put them in my basket, will you? I mean, that's what people used to say about it. The fact is that this is partly it's industry talking to other parts of industry, so it acts as a sort of networking. I mean, you know, industry doesn't talk to different parts of its own ecosystem as much as it should, and this sort of event brings it together. It also... It's a forum for industry collectively to think about what the challenges are. It's a way for governments to say, this is what we want, and that's what we've heard this week.
You're both nodding there. I just wonder if you want to add a little to it.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to an SME, actually, yesterday in the SME zone. And it's, by the way, that's another area where it's great to see more and more SMEs at this event. And he was telling me that, actually, to your point, Mike, that there was someone from France who did come over and said, you know what, there's a drone that you've got, which was absolutely aligned to their requirements. They wanted to displace another partner that they've got. And he said, right, and come over to Bordeaux in a couple of months because we want to really...
Right, and you wouldn't have known about it unless came here?
They would not have known about that unless they were here. So that just shows you the power of, you know, visualising the technology.
But also to your other point, Kate, when your critics say it's all about making money, of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course it is. All these companies have got shareholders.
Yeah.
And of course it's about making money. And it's. I mean, this is one thing the government is saying about the defence review, is that having to rearm, we don't want to rearm, but having to rearm in response to the international environment will also be a source of economic growth. It's not the way we choose to do it, but it's the way we are going to do it, because we've got to rearm anyway. And so it has to be something that links into the economy. So I'm completely relaxed about that. Of course it's about making money. It's about keeping the industry buoyant so that it can produce what it needs to produce, exactly as it did during the Second World War.
And this is an efficient way of doing that, because DSEI has the convening power to bring 32 country pavilions here. We've got delegations, I think, from 66 formal delegations invited by the government from 66 other countries coming here to see what's on display. And as well as then international industry talking to each other and discovering new things, those official delegations are looking at how the industry here can provide for their armed forces. And in UK terms, London and obviously the wider UK, this is a very significant inject to the economy. And that at the moment, as our government here in England is, in the United Kingdom is telling us, is really important. And tomorrow's focus here on the last day of DSEI is about how we sustain the people who are going to need to work across the industry and in the armed forces here in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. And that's a really important aspect as well.
Yeah, I'll just build on that a little bit on the people side, because there really is a battle for talent out there within all aspects of different industries. But the defence industry really needs to think about how it attracts top talent to the industry. If I'm a software developer and I've just graduated from university, I've got a plethora of organizations I can choose from. So I want to make sure that, you know, that software developer joins the sector. It doesn't matter which organization in the defense sector, the sector, rather than going into, say, financial services or retail. Yeah. So we've got to create, I think, much more of a purpose-driven approach to the sector.
So it's starting from the inside, going out, is that the whole point of it?
And I think there's a lot happening within the sector. So therefore, I don't think we should be precious about whether they join a Kinetic, a Talos, or MOD. I think it's just really important that we retain talent within the sector.
Does it worry you, Mike, that there aren't enough young people out there who can be part of this inflow of new blood?
It does genuinely worry me. I think...
Are we lacking in some of the basic skills?
Yes, we are. In certain areas, yes, we are. If you look at what we're, from a Talos point of view, what we do in sonar, you know, very, very specialist capability. We really need to create a talent pool of sonar engineers and scientists going forward. And that's going to be critical for sovereign capability. You know, the United Kingdom needs to be able to compete on the world stage. And we want to make sure that we continue to be a design authority for capability, not just manufacturing in the UK, a design authority.
But your talent pool can only start with people who are in their, let's say, their early 20s. You don't have any, well, much, you don't have much power to help to create an influx of people who are younger than that, coming through from the schools and the colleges and the tech colleges and the universities.
That's why STEM outreach is so important. And I know DSEI do a lot with STEM as well, but like it is really, really important that all organisations, that the private sector, that is industry that supports defence, as well as MOD, work together. And I would like to see us all working together more on STEM outreach. So we're not doing it individually, we're actually combining power.
Okay, let's dig into now what we've heard here so far at DSEI from ministers and British military leaders about what's expected of industry and to get our armed forces and the country as a whole ready for war fighting. I'm going to go through some key points from several of the keynote speeches. And let's start with the new Chief of the Defence Staff, Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton's first speech in the very top job of Britain's armed forces. Now, he focused on changing the relationship between industry and the forces to innovate at wartime pace. Mike, what does that mean, innovating at wartime pace?
It means several things. I mean, being prepared to accept failures, going for 80% efficiency, not 98% efficiency, building as you go, instead of starting at the top and working backwards and arriving there, you know, in 12 years' time, starting with what you've got now and innovating on what you've got. So it means several things, but it also means being able to do it quickly and, as both of our guests have said, bring in talents as you move forward.
What do you think?
The thing I thought that was most interesting yesterday was the Minister for Defence Readiness and Industry talking about tearing up the stupid rules. And as someone who worked in the Ministry of Defence for 7 years of my career, we were forever stumbling across these things, which really caused industry a great deal of grief because of the time that was involved. And the really big one, of course, was the annularity of the budget cycle, where at the end of March, everything had to start again for that new financial year. And he addressed that in his speech yesterday. And I think talking to industry folk around the floor plate over the last couple of days, if they could have a bit more certainty about how funding works over multiple years to get multiple settlements from the UK MOD, as some other countries do, then they'd be much happier to take a bit more risk, as you have said, Michael, and to put themselves out there a bit more, knowing that there was going to be a contract at the end.
What about tearing up stupid rules, Mike?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, you know,
have you had to do some yourself?
I only joined the sector, right, eight years ago, and yeah. I've found it a very, very slow sector. It is fascinating, and there are lots of rules and lots of processes. It's a complicated sector to be part of, but I think the introduction of, like, UKDI, which is the UK Defence Innovation Entity, is going to be really, really important. You know, they're going to be focused on higher TRL integration of technology, and I think that's going to be an enabler for that innovation going forwards. But you know, there's a lot to do in this space. What I would like, you know, coming from a large technology company, is the UK to place bets on key technologies that it wants to be known for. Maybe that's sensing technologies, maybe it's autonomy, maybe it's directed energy. I don't mind what it is, but if we can have a steer, then I can direct our R&D resources, that's the self-funded R&D like Talos does, to make sure that we're investing in the skills going forwards over a sort of 5 to 7 year horizon, because then that allows me to configure private sector investments in a way which ultimately will benefit our end users within the MOD. And if we can make those bets, then I think it'd be super helpful. At the moment, we're all sort of guessing, and that's not very efficient.
But some of those bets that you make, not all of them will work out, and sure. You've got to accept that. Yeah. And therefore, we need to say, like, in 10 years' time, when a couple of these bets didn't work out very well, that we avoid the blame culture. We're not going to have royal commissions on it. We just say, look, we had to do it at the time. We did it with the best of intention. Didn't work out very well. Move on.
Well, coming from the technology sector, we always had a mantra, which is, you know, fail fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really, really important. You do have to try it, see what happens. If it doesn't work, move on. And maybe leverage that activity or those ideas for something else, pivot it to another area.
And maybe this morning's briefing by the Ukrainian Defence Acquisition Minister will give us an idea as to how they're doing that in real life in a really difficult threat scenario right now, where people's lives are depending on technology working, or if it doesn't work, get rid of it and try something else.
The Ukrainians have had lots of failures over the last couple of years, but my goodness, they move on. They really move on.
Let's just go back to that keynote speech by the CDS. Another thing that stood out was he said, I'm surprised that I don't see shareholders investing to grow capacity and develop new products right across the enterprise. We need to see industry partners step up, just as we are asking the taxpayer to step up, and we'll do what we can to support you in every way. In a speech that mostly had a lot of praise for defence industry, that sound like a pretty pointed criticism, Neil?
I suppose it was. And one of the things we're doing here today at DSEI is talking about defence finance and how actually there needs to be a different approach to allowing investment in this industry better, not just by the primes, but when you talk to SMEs, the flow of cash within their businesses as they try to develop new technology, which might not work first time, that's the really critical thing. So large investment organisations need to be focused on that.
Mike, so is it fair?
I think it's very fair. I mean, we talk about defence reform, there needs to be industry reform at the same time. And I think where you've got a lot of organisations that have been part of this sector for a while, complacency kicks in. So yes, all organisations need to change. The dynamics change, and I think it's great to see new entrants into the sector like Helsing, like Andrew and others, because it just makes people think a bit more, makes people focus, and it makes, you know, organisations like the larger, more traditional organisations react positively. So it creates a healthy dynamic within the sector.
Yeah, some good news on this case in the sense that private equity is beginning to swing behind defence innovation. It never used to, because they never really thought that defence innovation would go far enough, fast enough. But a lot of private equity funds are looking around now. They're frightened away from a lot of American operations for, you know, obvious reasons. And they're looking around for where are the new profits. And they find them in the technology sector. They find them in AI. And they particularly now find them in defence. And so quite a lot of private equity is flowing into small, innovative defence enterprises. And that's a good piece of good news if it can be integrated, if it can really act as one of the stimuli for this bigger defence ecosystem that we're talking about.
And there's that question about ethics, but actually when the threat is now so prominent and close, actually we need to move on that debate.
I'm just interested to hear your insight, Neil, about how it's all going down here, those kind of comments, because there are some speeches, question and answer sessions, that and many private conversations that we can't report on. Just what do you get to hear?
So I think some of the keynotes have gone down really well, and starting with the couple of ministers that we had on Tuesday, they are all talking about reforming the rule book, about making, and this is UK focused, obviously, but about making UK defence much slicker at getting with industry and then moving ahead on a procurement timescale that is taking years and moving that to months. And they're all coming up with that. Now, we've heard that before.
Yeah, I was about to say.
We have heard that before. And, you know, in the army, we have had a couple of programmes that have gone on for many years, which are well known about. But actually, I sense that the imperative is there because of what we're seeing in Europe and because of what some of our European partners are doing, changing very well their acquisition techniques and their processes. And we need to be looking at what they're up to. I mean, Poland is a great example. Look what's happening in Germany right now. You know, these are countries which are absolutely accelerating their defence enterprise.
But downstairs on the floor, Neil, do you detect that undercurrent of cynicism? Is it still there?
Of course, because...
very hard-nosed people down there.
And Mike will tell us, you know, people have been around the block a bit, and
yes.
And we have heard some of these buzzwords a few times before here at DSEI, but there is that now, that very adjacent threat, which I think means that people are waking up to this.
And I guess this is an opportunity to inject some energy into the whole debate, isn't it? Let's pick up on some of the key points from the speech of the new Defence Procurement Minister, Luke Pollard. His big challenge was speeding things up. Not only is the Ministry of Defence too slow in its procurement, he says, industry is reflecting that back. Things that take 5 years need to take two. Things that take 2 years need to take one. Yeah, we did talk about moving down those timeframes. I mean, do you think... it's feasible, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, what I really like about the STR is the categorisation of capabilities. They talk about these three categories of capability. You know, you've got on the right-hand side, the big submarines, tanks, etc., etc. In the middle, you've got spiral development. And then on the left-hand side, you've got, rapid integration of existing technologies. So if the defence sector can then create an operating model approach which is different for each of those segments, leveraging the likes of, I don't know, Commercial X, which I think have been really, really successful to drive rapid procurement and rapid commercials for the you know, more innovative types of capability, then that will work. But it does, at the moment, there is a sort of one-size-fits-all model, and that doesn't work. So we've got to create different operating approaches across the whole life cycle of capability for the different risk profiles.
And I attended a reception last night for the launch of Cyber and Specialist Operations Command. And I think that really feels like it's happening there because they're not dealing in the main with heavy metal.
Right.
Because they are dealing with high technology software integrators and the likes of the companies you mentioned around satellites and so on. And there is a different flavour there. We now need to push that out into other parts of defence and ensure that when it is about capital projects, that we do those in a different way as well.
Yep.
And we learn from what CSOC is doing.
Do you think there's anything else that could be done, Mike?
Oh, I mean, you need to do more of everything across the piece. But, I mean, what's important is that there is a governmental push and that industry this time believes they mean it. And that there won't be another defence industrial strategy in 2 years' time or a change of government. I mean, there may be a change of government, but there is a sense now in which we say that this is the line down which we have to go. And there won't be much deviation from that line because, you know, on a cross-party basis, we are reacting to the world outside. So I think that's changed the dynamic between government and industry, which since the end of the Cold War has not been great. Mm. It really hasn't been great. Industry, by and large, hasn't really believed what government said because not that they thought government was lying to them, but they didn't think they would be consistent over time. And industry was constantly being urged to invest its own shareholders' money into big new plants, you know, 10 million or 100 million for this or that. And then the policy changes.
Mm.
That, I think, is gone now. And I think that new dynamic between government and industry is the first I've seen in the last 30 or 40 years that really does feel different.
I think if I just pick up on one thing, that the question that was coming up on quite a lot of the exhibitors' stands was around the defence investment plan.
Yeah.
So we've seen the strategy in the SDR. It's laid out the pathway. Lord Coker, I think, said on Tuesday, sometime this autumn, which is a is a sort of 3 or 4 month window, isn't it? It needs to come because people like Mike and his company need to know where the priorities are going to be and where the investment's going to be made.
Are you impatient for that, Mike?
Well, we would love to see that. I mean, at the end of the day, that's where the rubber hits the road when it comes to where investment's going to be. And they're going to have to be tough choices that are made, and things are going to have to be turned off. And that's going to annoy some people and make other people happy. And that's the reality, because the budget has to be reprioritised, I think.
Do you remember, Kate, in the last special that we did on SITREP, we had Richard Barrons, who was one of the three writers, the three directors of Strategic Defence Review. And Richard said, look, we have a programme, it's a 10-year programme, it will work out. All we've got to do now is deliver it. Just do it. There it is. Do it. And so that's where we are. We know what we've got to do. We know it will work. Just do it.
You all mentioned the appeal to rip up the stupid rules. Just wondering what kind of examples come to mind. Who wants to volunteer?
Well, I'll just tell you a little story about another SME that I talked to yesterday. Again, they started a particular programme and they bid for it. This is traditional defence. Went through the whole cycle, and it's taken them around about 14 months from the start of that cycle to actually... And they've been told in a few weeks' time that they may get a decision over that. That's 14 months just to actually have that discussion. Now, if you're an SME, you haven't got the capacity to keep these two type of things going. The same SME then said they had been working with Commercial X on a different type of project. It's the same capability that they've got, and they've actually transacted the whole thing and got it done within a month. So it just shows you that defence can work in collaboration with industry really, really well. But we just need to actually... drive some of the great thinking that Commercial X is doing across wider parts of the development.
And over 14 months, it will have cost them a fair amount of money to make a bid that they may fail.
Not only cost...
And so next time they think, are we really going to commit this much time and money to a bid that we may not get?
Not only cost them, but just think about also the amount of people in mod procurement, mod commercial mod programmes who are also spending their time, you know, and then evaluating, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So the answer is get on with it. If you're going to turn it down, turn it down, fine. If you're going to accept it, accept it, but don't mess about.
I'll give you another one as well, and that is that despite the implementation of the National Armament Director Group that theoretically runs acquisition for UK MOD, I was talking to a drone manufacturer yesterday, an RPAS manufacturer, so an air drone, and the confusion about how you can certify air platforms that are going to be flown remotely in the United Kingdom around the CAA regulations, the MAA regulations, the regulations for the various ranges that we have and so on. All of that is actually putting to a place where they can't afford to continue. It's taken so long to get flying. Meanwhile, we know in Ukraine, drones have evolved over the last 2 years from a very basic level to highly sophisticated. But we're falling behind.
Because they don't have to worry about the CAA.
When you're fighting for your existence, though, the rules are...
I think the answer to this question, Kate, is don't get us started.
But Neil, rules exist for reasons, and militaries love a rule book. Is there a danger of making things worse, not better?
Well, of course, there is a rule book, and there's doctrine, and people follow that. But the best generals are those who tend to innovate and change the rules as they're going along, who adapt. Think of Bill Slim. Think of Percy Hobart in World War II with all of the tanks that he designed to get over obstacles created by the opposition. And actually, we see in Ukraine... people adapting the rulebook in order to defeat the Russians, because they're changing as well. So rapid changing of the rules, bringing industry along with us, is what we want to see.
And, you know, Percy Hobart was a retired major general, 2-star, and at the time when Churchill brought him back to produce Hobart's funnies for the invasion, he was a lance corporal, right, in the Home Guard. And Churchill pulled him out to say, this man is an innovator. And he produced all the Hobart's funnies, which made such a difference on D-Day.
I knew you'd had a good historical little nugget there. Thank you.
He was like Private Godfrey in Dad's Army. He was a Lance Corporal in the Home Guard.
Well, let's look at the key mission, warfighting readiness. Let's take an example given in the speech from the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander, Europe. Russia is firing 27,000 artillery shells a day in Ukraine. How far away is UK defence and the UK defence industry from being ready for that kind of level of sustained support for our armed forces? Who wants to go for that one?
Well, let me start with, Under this, the theme this week at DSEI, preparing the future force, the first thing that we have focused on is the security of the supply line. So improving the acquisition of new equipment, yes, but getting our supply chains absolutely secure so that UK armed forces and those of our allies can guarantee that they've got what they need, not just to fight for that first week, but to keep the fight, to sustain the fight. We can come on to people later, but if you don't have the equipment and the ammunition supplies and the fuel and the vehicles to move it around and get it across Europe or wherever, then you haven't got a capability.
Mm. And we're talking about doing this quickly though, aren't we? How quickly can it be done, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges actually, because we can talk about the challenges of transformation and new technologies, and they're pretty big, but there's a more basic challenge, as Neil says, of having enough pipelines, enough vehicles, enough aircrafts, some of the old stuff that the same sort of stuff that we needed 50 and 80 years ago, we still need in much higher numbers than we have. And by we, I mean all of the European NATO allies. So there's still a big job in good old basic engineering to have the as it were, the bread and butter material that is available for logistics.
I think, as Mike's saying there, though, I think it is about the end game. We need to be actually looking at, you know, the existing capability, rearming the UK, for example. And I think industry have really led into that, leans into that now to actually, you know, invest in resilient supply chains. But it is that and looking at the new technologies as well, and the challenges that quite often are using the same skill base.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people down there, down on the floor, who are doing supply chain logistics. Just looking around the exhibition, there's a lot of logistics available down there with new solutions.
A lot to learn then, Neil.
There is. And of course, to do that, back to our earlier point about people, you need people who understand logistics, which are not straightforward, and you need people to be trained up in that. And of course, the competitors, you know, that those who deliver our Amazon parcels every day to our house are logistics experts. How can we entice some of those people into the defence sector to do that? And how then do we produce the people who manufacture this high-tech equipment, ammunition and so on to reinforce our supply chain?
That's the third time we've mentioned Amazon in this particular discussion.
But, we're not sponsored.
But the point is important, because not for Amazon's sake, but the point is important that modern society has terrific logistics. Look at modern supply chains for the consumer market. The logistics are terrific. And the military has lagged behind those innovations for years, but is catching up now. And that's the integration point. You know, our own societies are really good at logistics, and we've got to bring that into the military profession as well.
And Mike, we know much of this is about Ukraine. How much has the defence industry changed for you and speeded up since that invasion happened?
I think it's changed an awful lot, because it creates a very, very clear focus and purpose. I think, you know, there's obviously examples of urgent operational requirements, which is when industry and MOD work, I think, really, really well together. You've got a very critical focus. You know, industry and MOD are problem solvers. You know, when you get those groups together focused on solving a problem, things can happen very, very quickly. And interestingly, in those scenarios, the rule books get parked. So it shows that we can make these things happen. We just need to ultimately scale it.
You mentioned the Ukrainian official is going to be talking soon. What will you be looking for? What kind of clues will you be looking for?
I think it will be about how they have centred this urgent operational requirement process and managed to persuade industry, not just obviously in Ukraine, but across Europe and in the United States, the industries that are supporting them, to invest in that potential that something isn't going to work, so it will fail. They'll learn the lessons very quickly and go back and try again. And that lack of being too risk averse is what we find when the operational imperative is right there. Yeah. There is a danger in UK society generally, I guess, but particularly in defence when it's not facing a really imminent threat, that it's risk averse, it's overly cautious, and industry wants to push on, and we need to support them in defence.
Our own urgent operational requirements process worked really very well during Iraq and Afghanistan, but it was regarded by the Treasury as exceptional, and when we get back to normal, then we can do away with it again. We can get back to the way we were. The point now is that everything is an urgent operational requirement, and that's the point. It's not exceptional anymore. We knew how to do it then. It was done for certain lines, and it really did work well. Well, okay, we know we can do it, but we need the Treasury to accept that this is the new normal.
And it needs to be faster, because I remember for the first time I went to Afghanistan in 2006-07, we were struggling with equipment and supply chains and so on. It took 2 years to sort that out.
Yeah. But it did come through.
And it did come through. And then by 2009, things were
doing well.
Better.
Doing well.
Well, that's too slow, that 2 years.
Could you just give us a percentage then, Neil, from where we were in 2021, a peacetime industry at 0%, to full warfighting readiness being 100%? Where are we on that path at the moment, do you think?
I don't think I can put a figure on that. There are elements of the UK armed forces, and we're talking about the UK here, the UK armed forces that are very ready. We've got Typhoons on quick reaction alert 24/7. We've got the deployed nuclear deterrent 24/7 and so on. There are other areas of defence which are not ready at all. Let's just leave it like that.
Okay, I won't ask you, will I? Do you want to risk it and say which areas?
Well, my daughter's in the army today, and there are elements in her organisation that are very ready. She's got friends in various other cap badges and parts of the army who, frankly, do not have the equipment nor indeed the ammunition they need.
Mike, the CDS recognised that businesses have to make money too. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance all of that out?
Well, I think it can be balanced. You know, businesses, as we said earlier, you know, the industry is here to make a profit, and that is an important part of, you know, the equation. But at the same time, a lot of the people who work for industry are purpose driven, and they do want to make sure that what they're building is driving, you know, progress for our warfighters. And you see that in all members, whether you're an SME, whether you're a large industry player. So I think there is absolutely a balance there that can be struck.
And can and will business, defence business, shift that balance between duty to shareholders and duty to the country?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that to be the case. And, you know, I think, like I say, we need to be purpose driven as an industry industry as a whole. That's how we attract our people. You know, building, getting engineers, whatever flavour they come in, and saying we're here to create a profit of X, that's not attractive to people.
No.
What's attractive to people is protecting lives, protecting sovereign interests, and building technology that can actually help with that.
And that comes across as you walk around the floor plate. People are proud of the products they've got.
Yeah, right.
And they're proud to be part of the defence arena.
That's right. That's right.
Let's just finish on the big picture of the shared mission, keeping the country safe by being ready for war fighting. Ideally, that prevents war through deterrence. But if we pick up another quote from the Chief of Defence's staff's speech, history tells us, he said, that if we don't win quickly, we must also be ready to sustain that fight. We need to be able to do both, but which requires more effort and investment right now, Neil?
I think this goes back to the Strategic Defence Review and its very clear articulation that this is a national effort. So wars are not fought and won by armed forces. They're fought and won by countries. They're fought and won by populations who get behind the mission. And that means that across all walks of life, people need to understand the defence enterprise better. Part of that is demystifying things. So as Michael said earlier on, you know, we do logistics really well in our civilian lives. I bet nobody understands logistics in defence unless they're actually in defence. So how do we demystify that? How do we attract people into it? How does the whole of the nation understand the imperative and how we should go about that business?
Mike, you're in defence and it's a process, not an event. How long will it take for us to have a defence industry capable of sustained support for war-fighting armed forces?
Well, I think it's developing right now. I mean, like I said before, I mean, I've been here 8 years. I've seen industry the shape of industry change dramatically, and that ecosystem is changing. So I think, you know, the more competition that comes in, the more we attract organisations from outside of defence into defence. I think we'll be absolutely ready to support the national mission.
Mike, how long do we have?
Not long. According to most of our NATO allies, 5 years. Some say 2 years. I mean, I think we're in for a military confrontation with Russia sooner rather than later of some sort. But we're back to the old cliche that, you know, professional armies start wars and citizen armies finish wars. And which is Neil's point, really, that warfare is about society. And to avoid a war, then we have to be prepared to fight one. And that means that we as a society have got to make that psychological leap to understanding that we're back to, you know, what is more typical of our history for the last 2,000 years, that we are prepared to go to war. Not that it's an exception, but it may turn out to be the rule. And maybe we can avoid it. But if we make that psychological adjustment, if we're prepared to make the investment, then we've got a good chance of living in an armed peace for the next two or three generations. That's the best offer we can make. And if members of the public came and looked at the exhibition downstairs at DSEI, they might be a little bit shocked at the number of, I don't know, bullets and rounds and artillery ammunition that they see, the pointy things down there. But if they stay long enough and look around and talk to people, I think they would get a sense of the shared enterprise that DSEI offers toward that mobilization, psychological mobilization, as well as a physical mobilization of our society to avoid a war we really don't want to have to fight.
And that public awareness is really important, isn't it, Neil?
Yes, it is. And we've made an effort here to be as transparent as we can about what happens here. As I said before, the international reach of DSEI is one of its huge attractions. It is the largest of these trade fairs for the defence sector across the world. And the number of visitors, 45,000-50,000 over the course of 4 days. And we've seen, you know, a lot of publicity about the show. So I think that's good.
It's really great speaking to you all. Thank you so much for your time today. Major General Neil Sexton, Mike Seward and Michael Clark, of course, thank you very much. There is much more from DSEI from BFBS Forces News YouTube channel. You can see it there. I'll be back with another sit rep next Thursday. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.